Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. Everybody's waiting.
Critically, both the zoomed-in philosophy and the zoomed-out philosophy have bits of truth, maybe very important. It might be incredibly important to go down to the most logical, finest grain understanding of some phenomenon in order to understand it, and it might be profoundly important to keep zooming out until you understand how the whole thing interconnects. But it's even more important to have both of those resolutions at the same time, so you can recognize, okay, this is true and it's zoomed in, and this is true and it's zoomed out, and here's how they interrelate. Unfortunately, I see that with formal education, it almost always disposes people to be too far zoomed in. They have some type of technical expertise, technical understanding of something, and they don't even realize that some of those assumptions are probably mistaken, or they come from other fields of thought, or their various fields of thought are interconnected. And so the actual quality of their conclusions is very, very poor, despite being technically educated, because they have not zoomed out enough. It would be akin to somebody confidently saying, hey, listen, I have a degree in physics, and I can tell you, you cannot boil water simply by changing the position of the knob on your stove. Right? There's a kind of over-education and over-focus where they actually, their conclusions are completely wrong, despite them having some very focused understanding of the truth. Because they missed the big picture, they effectively have built some theory that does not correctly explain reality. A good analogy might be literally like taking pictures of reality. If you try to understand the world, if you try to understand what Earth is by looking into a microscope, and that's all of the pictures that you have of the world or what it looks like under a microscope, you're not going to understand what the world is. Similarly, if you try to understand what the world is by imagining what it would look like from the perspective of the sun, you know, if you're 90 million miles away from Earth and you're looking at it, I know what the world is. It is a blue dot in a field of black. You're going to be missing all of the details if you had various pictures of different resolutions. In fact, all of the resolutions are important because reality is very, 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 very vast. So you want to have the microscopic, you want to have the macroscopic, and the whole range in between. I hope you guys find that helpful. You'll find that over time, if you try to intentionally zoom in and say, okay, I'm going to try to understand the details of cause and effect here, your understanding will increase. And if you try to intentionally zoom out and say, okay, what are the other variables? How do they interconnect? Your understanding will increase. And then you may realize that this is kind of a primary skill in really having strong critical thinking ability, is to manually and intentionally adjust your level of zooming in and zooming out.
Hello, dear friends. This is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is July 15th. This is the continuation of my conversation with Steve Patterson. In this portion, we will discuss a critical thinking technique. Steve calls it zooming in and zooming out. It was the title of a video that Steve put on his YouTube channel, back in March, just when most people needed to start practicing this technique, but they didn't. No judgment. I had some trouble with it myself. So I included a clip from that video at the beginning of the show just so you could get a sense of what we're going to be talking about and applying to the controversies of the year so far. I certainly hope you enjoyed part one. I know I kind of left you hanging there at the end. We are going to pick this up right where we left off. Remember to check out his work at steve-patterson.com. His podcast is Patterson in Pursuit. His book, linked in the show notes, is Square One, The Foundations of Knowledge. And you can find him on YouTube as well, where he has assembled a fine collection of monologues, dialogues, and debates, mostly on philosophy, but on many other topics as well. All right, thanks for listening. Here we go.
So, long story short, you're leaving the country.
There you go. Pretty much, yeah. Just for some period of time. If there's violence, I want to be here for it.
Yeah, we share a lot of the same observations about the last 6 months, about the last few years. I wanted to talk a little bit about a video you put up, I think, about 3 months ago. It was called Zooming In and Zooming Out, a back to basics critical thinking thing worth spending some time on here. So relevant to the situation with the coronavirus controversy as well. And a lot of the missteps from so-called public health officials and people in government, but also in a lot of the public commentary about it. So can you just explain to the audience what is meant by zooming in and zooming out in an approach to trying to understand something?
Yeah. So it's just a method of critical thinking. And the example I give in the video that actually in part comes from an interview I did on Bob Murphy's show. We were talking about the methodology of economics, which is very fascinating if people are interested in that subject. But it's observing a pot of water boiling on a stove.
Yeah.
And you ask, okay, why is the water boiling? You can use the techniques of zooming in and zooming out to try to better understand why the pot of water is boiling and to avoid particular errors of thought. So you could zoom in. Let's say you zoom in and you try to understand more in more detail why the water is boiling. Well, you observed the phenomena take place that prior to the water boiling, somebody turned the knob on the stovetop. And you observe that, oh, well, there was a flame or this with something, some hot stuff underneath the pot that we call a flame. And then there was little bubbles. And then, you know, you observe the phenomena more closely and then you try to say, okay, well, maybe there's a causal connection between these things. And so you can zoom in even more tightly and you go, okay, well, why is it the case that the flame underneath the pot resulted in the water boiling? Is there some connection to heat here? Like maybe we'll have come up with a concept of heat. The heat from the flame gets transferred into the water. And then if the water gets hot enough, then it starts to boil. Okay, great. We're zooming in. We zoom in even farther. And we look at the causal chain of events. Okay, we say, okay, why did the flame get turned on in the first place? And we go, ah, well, the person turned the knob. That was the beginning of the causal chain. And then somebody might be zoomed in too far. And they go, okay, I'm going to use pure logic to understand why the pot of water started boiling. And I ask the question, is it the case that turning the knob on the stovetop itself causes the water to boil? The spatial orientation of the knob, is that the thing which causes the water to boil since we're zoomed in? And somebody who's very far zoomed in will say, no, actually, you can't cause water to boil simply by changing the orientation of the knob. These things, two things are totally causally unrelated. If you imagine a thought experiment, imagine everything else constant, and the only thing that changes is the spatial orientation of the knob. Does that cause the water to boil itself? No, of course. You have to have this other chain of events. So the person who's too far zoomed in concludes, oh, you actually can't boil water by turning the knob on your stovetop, which I think is a mistaken conclusion.
Right.
Because they're too far zoomed in. They're reducing variables to smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller set. And then they miss the fact that actually variables are interconnected.
Missing connection. Yep, exactly. Yep.
Right. So it's the same thing happens when you're zooming out. So somebody that's zooming out is like, okay, well, you start with the phenomena you're observing and then you zoom out. And it's like, okay, so I noticed that there is this connection between the knob and the water boiling. Well, why does that happen? And then you might start asking questions about physics. Like, why is it the case that heat is part of the universe? What is this heat stuff in the first place? And you zoom out even farther and you're like, hang on, there's these things. It seems like there are laws of physics. Why are there laws of physics and how do they work? And you zoom out even farther and you're like, wow, we might live in a physical universe. What is the cause of the existence of the physical universe? And somebody might conclude, well, you know, the Big Bang is the reason that there is a physical universe, or God is the reason that there's a physical universe. And so the person who's too far zoomed out goes, you know, what is the cause of the water boiling? God is the cause of the water boiling, because, or the Big Bang is the cause of the water boiling, which is way too far zoomed out, probably, for the purposes of trying to understand the phenomena of the water boiling on the stovetop.
So this relates, I would say, to like an understanding and practice of systems thinking to a certain extent, in lots of ways. You can look at numerous disciplines and probably see people who are too zoomed in or too zoomed out. If people are trying to tell themselves stories, like we talked about in the last segment, where they're just looking for, they wouldn't call it a false sense of solution or resolution or understanding, but they'll take it. I mean, that's what a lot of people, you know, will sit at a rest stop on the highway and go, this is where I wanted to go for vacation, actually. Like in an intellectual way, they'll do that. I borrowed that from my friend Richard Grove. But I think it's situation dependent too, whether people are want to be too zoomed in on something or too zoomed out. I think there's lots of examples around the coronavirus controversy in response to this. And I saw this video around the time you posted it, and it didn't mean as much. I mean, of course, I said, oh, another great video from Steve. I watched it. I thought it was a useful heuristic for systems thinking, or maybe leading people into a deeper exploration of that. I've spent the last couple months on my show trying to, we've been doing a series called This is a Test. My friend Daryl Becker and I have been working on trying to unravel some of the mysteries or the perception management around the COVID thing, right? Now, there were times where, I mean, I can't think of an event in my life that was just more complex in so many ways, arcane, so many aspects of it that are difficult to understand, so many causal chains that are so hard to figure out, and to see the system of the whole thing. And there were times where, you know, I'd be in conversation on the show and I'd be saying, well, you know, these health professionals, this medical establishment, they write an open letter saying that it's okay to protest for George Floyd, but then they condemn protesting, like in the same letter. It's not like they let 2 weeks go by. They say it's okay to protest against racism because it's a public health issue, but it is not okay to protest lockdowns. This is one page that feat is accomplished. And way zoomed out, I say, well, how could you trust a profession like this where people are so thoughtlessly conformist and obedient, right? And cave into political pressure. But that doesn't invalidate any scientific conclusion that any of them have made, right? So to make a blanket statement, to be way zoomed out and looking at this, and or condemning this as a profession for that example, that open letter example, or 100 other large scale examples that we could think of. But I've also been hyper focused on one line of you know, proteins in the sequence genome of the virus, and trying to understand how a PCR test can find that thing, you know, and being like, wow, this is a, I don't know if it can, I don't get how it can do that. So then I'm way too zoomed in on the whole thing. So I've had a lot of experiences just in the last couple months around trying to incorporate systems thinking into, you know, being accountable to what I say on my own show about this thing where the stakes are really high, you know?
Yeah, it's a great example. I mean, gosh, that is, you could use this, the method of zooming in and zooming out endlessly when thinking about COVID. I have my own thoughts on the subject. In the area of my research, because I tend to be more focused on the types of things that academics are focused on, I see zooming in abused all the time.
Yeah,
I mean, by virtually every thinker in every area, because the incentive structure of the modern academy is such where it pushes you towards specialization and focus on your one thing. And academics tend to be incomprehensibly poor at zooming out. And in fact, they're so bad at zooming out, many of them don't even know that zooming out is a thing you can do, or they don't think it's relevant. They think it's, well, there's endless examples of this, but they think like And mathematics, something I always enjoy talking about. The mathematicians, some mathematicians don't even know that the philosophy of mathematics is a domain of inquiry.
Yeah.
Some of them think it's when you ask questions like, well, what exactly are numbers and do mathematical processes continue on when people aren't thinking about them? Does the universe undertake mathematical processes or is that something that humans do? They go, oh, that's a question for philosophers. And they throw up their hands. They don't even realize, apparently, they don't even realize that that question has mathematical implications. The more you zoom out, if you're doing it correctly, you can figure out that everything is framed wrong. And yeah. So it doesn't matter how far zoomed in, you're really good at mathematical calculation, but you don't even realize that you're using a formula that was disproven 50 years ago because you've not zoomed out enough.
Oh, absolutely. And obviously when the sciences get a little softer in higher yeah. education, you run into more of this where people are so hyper-focused on their own conclusions that, again, their work is just an ongoing process of confirmation bias, basically.
Yes, and in the hard sciences as well.
So okay, sure,
COVID would be a good example. I can give you many other examples if you're interested, but
yeah.
This whole COVID thing be a good example. The whole thing is framed completely incorrectly. It's like not even...
Well, the technical expertise forces that zoom in to that degree,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. So there are many things to say on COVID. One is, it is at least worth pointing out that I believe the average age or the median age of people dying from COVID in the States is over 80, something like that,
yeah.
give or take.
Yeah.
That roughly half the deaths are taking place in nursing homes.
Yes.
And that the deaths are way concentrated in New England for whatever reason, compared to almost anywhere else in the States and almost anywhere else in the rest of the world. An interesting phenomenon. Japan, one of the places I think is more rational and trust in public institutions is more justified. They have the oldest population in the world. They didn't have any mandatory lockdowns, and something around 1,000 people have died from COVID. An interesting data point that might demand some explanation if somebody really wants to figure this whole thing out.
But right.
The whole thing is framed incorrectly because normal people have no idea how many deaths occur each year from respiratory infections. And why would they? Why would anybody think to them? Why would any normal person be concerned about the bad flu season to any considerable extent? You know, maybe if you're in ill health, it's something you really need to pay attention to. It's not something that's on anybody's radar. So when when the media, when medical professionals tell you that we might have 150,000 people die from a new respiratory infection, you might think to yourself, wow, that is just the most horrible thing I've ever heard. 100,000 people died in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 100,000, 50,000 people, good heavens. It's totally framed incorrectly because you have no idea what the baseline is.
Right.
The baseline is like the last really bad flu season in the States killed, I think it was 80,000 people, 100,000 people, something like that. And it's very hard to get these metrics anyway. So imagine now the topic was framed like this. We may be dealing with a scourge, a respiratory infection that kills 1.5 times as many people as the last really bad flu season. And because of that scourge, I propose that we force people to stay inside their homes, to shelter in place, to lock down the economy, lock down international travel, to prevent people from getting together in groups, gathering more than two people together, even if they're family, that can be a problem. If they're neighbors, you can't do it. It can be illegal. Maybe we lock people up if they violate the social distancing norms, if they get fined and they don't pay the fines that comes with a threat of violence. If you were to phrase things that way, like the most significant interventions in the last century, certainly in the last several generations and
sure.
probably unprecedented outside of time of war, for the potential worry of a 1.5 times the last really bad flu season, I don't think people would consider that reasonable. They wouldn't consider the response even close to being reasonable. It's framed completely incorrectly. That's
right.
A case of people like they don't... And with a zooming in and zooming out, they don't even have a baseline to start. If it was 15,000, they might go, oh my gosh, that's a lot. 150,000, oh my gosh, that's a lot. A million, that's a lot. It just depends on what the media is saying is above baseline or something that's normal.
So their framing errors may be completely intentional too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, things are going to be framed in the most dire terms. And obviously, a little bit of slack. Back in February and March, it was probably hard to tell. A lot of these projections were made on things that have since been changed, like asymptomatic spreading, the virus particles being able to stay on surfaces.
But there's a framing mistake here as well, because The framing mistake is something like, oh, they just got the details wrong. They got the details of the models wrong, but we didn't know. I actually don't think that's the correct framing. I think the correct framing is something like, you have to have already extremely high-level research with very high epistemic standards to justify a fraction of the interventions that we've seen. I don't think it's like, well, next time, you know, we've got the Imperial College phone line. It's a red phone in the Oval Office. And when they call, whatever they say, well, okay, the Imperial College said this, we're going to lock everything down because we don't know. I just don't think that's a good method. I think that's framed incorrectly. It should be like, you're claiming we need to do what? We need to really get to the bottom of this before we make the most massive interventions in people's lives and cause tens of millions of people to lose their jobs and their livelihoods in a matter of months.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the reason why people submitted to that is the whole thing just seemed so boundless, right? Like, as a system, it had no boundary. It was very amorphous. Nobody knew how far this could go. Is this a swimming pool or is this the ocean? You know,
right?
Yeah,
right. But isn't this another example in the face of uncertainty?
Well, what I'm saying though is framing. It had things been framed better, if assuming people had the capability at the time and the knowledge at the time to frame them better, so much of that could have been prevented. Again,
yes,
we're giving people lots of benefit of doubt.
In the world in which it is incredibly difficult to get high quality knowledge about anything, much less something as fantastically complex as a new respiratory disease. Mm-hmm. I think the default should be complete and utter inaction by states. Now, it makes sense that the relative risk populations, like the nursing home populations, they have the natural incentive to kind of keep on top of maybe some medical research that's going on. If there's some new coronavirus that they're worried about, maybe they take new precautions. But in the face of uncertainty and a reality that's so complex, it's difficult to get good knowledge, high quality knowledge about. I just think the default needs to be inaction, because especially like the amount of subjects that I'm doing research on from the skeptical perspective, double checking the claims of academics. Mm-hmm. They're wrong about everything all the time at the most fundamental and trivial level.
Yeah.
So that the idea that these people are the one we're waiting on, we got to make sure they apply their contemporary scientific process to determine whether or not I'm going to be locked in my house. That's a very bad procedure. I don't want to live in that type of a society. And to the Japanese government's credit, they actually said something which I've never heard any politician in the States say. They said, we don't have the authority to have a mandatory lockdown. Like we, the government, literally do not have the legal authority to enact this. So we're going to discourage people. We're going to have public announcements. Please stay in your home. But we don't have the authority to do this. I've never heard an American politician say that ever. I mean, I've heard Ron Paul say that, but that's the one exception to, you know, the gang of 435.
Sure. People certainly signaled, like people on the right certainly signaled disapproval of it and like, let's get things reopened and let's be free, blah, blah, blah. But no one, you're right, said or would ever say, we don't have the authority.
And much less act it out. Can you imagine? Oh, yeah. Can you imagine living in a society where your public officials are like, hey, listen, you know, it might be safer for you if we had more control and could, you know, prevent things from happening. But we just don't have the legal authority. You're going to have to go. You're going to have to take care of it yourself and be a responsible citizen yourself. Can you imagine?
No, those days are, I mean, I'm trying to think about a time in this country when that could have even been plausible. It probably would have been before I was born.
Yeah, you know? Probably.
If ever.
So.
I mean, well, the medical establishment and public health experts, so-called, are too zoomed in.
With one exception. Okay. So something I keep discovering in various areas, and it's very true of the medical world as well, is there tends to be a minority of dissenters that are still in the medical establishment. So it would be painting with too broad a brush to say this is everybody, this is the vast, vast majority of people believe this. I think what's going on is you have a powerful vocal minority gain prestige and power and influence by promoting hysteria. You have the 80% or 70% in the middle that are kind of clueless and just kind of go along with whatever the authorities say. They really don't understand anything. And then maybe you have the 10% or so, maybe that's an overestimation, but 5%, who actually, or medical professionals who think to themselves, this is a bunch of bullshit. Or I know this is going to fail, and here's the reasons why. Because I have come across some articles and some videos from people who are still somehow in the formal medical establishment strongly criticizing the government's reaction to COVID all around the world. Professor Witkowski or whatever his name is, he had a great series of videos. John Ioannidis has been pretty good in criticizing stuff. And something that kills me when I read these academics writing like Ioannidis and others is, on the one hand, they'll say things like, we have not even established the basic cause and effect between a lockdown and reducing the total amount of deaths in a population, the most elementary cause and effect relationship.
Right.
And in the same breath, in the same sentence or whatever, they'll say, so more research is needed and we need to be very cautious and careful and appeal to the scientific process and trust that the experts are going to figure these things out.
Right.
And I'm thinking, how can you hold these two things simultaneously? If it's true that if you're saying the most elementary connection between lockdowns and saving lives isn't even established, and it doesn't appear to be established, because we do have Sweden as an interesting case here when they didn't lock down, and Japan's another interesting case. you can't somehow conclude that the people in this establishment are really deep and critical and careful thinkers. You can't. It's like if there's a mathematician who has blundered on 2 + 2. You can't be like, well, we have to see if he changes his mind. You give him a few years and we'll give him, you know, we'll listen to his research and read his publications for the next 10 years because he is a professional after all. And we'll see, maybe he's somebody, you know, we should definitely take seriously.
Right.
Like, no, in my opinion, the conclusion is these people truly do not understand the basics. They don't understand the basics. A small percentage of them might.
Well, I think another thing that has a softening effect on the rigor that these people apply to what they do and to what they say is that, I mean, let's face it, they're one-eyed men in a kingdom of the blind. So, like, what's at stake for being wrong? There's not going to be any accountability. Nobody that you're telling, including the person on the news who is the supposed disseminator of information, they have no idea what you're talking about. They're just eating out of your hand, too. So it's not like, I can't imagine being a so-called public health expert and feeling like there's a lot at stake for whatever I say, you know? Sure, there's going to be the David Icke's of the world and the lunatics and, but whatever. We all just have to deal with them. But it's not like, I'm going to be subjected to any effective scrutiny. And I think these people know that. And I think that makes them lazy. And I think we see that across just about every discipline.
I think that is true. It does contribute to laziness, but it also is a great opportunity for the ambitious.
Yeah.
Because if something like public health seems to be a one domain in which regular people are eager to listen to the experts and submit to whatever they say and maybe pay them a little bit more so they can do some higher quality research and maybe put them, maybe make their own department.
Oh, yeah.
In government to make sure that they get the truth right, because I don't want to catch an infectious disease. Mm-hmm. So that seems to me ripe for somebody like a Fauci, some ambitious individual who has interesting investments around the world and an interesting story, to leverage that to further your own career. And by the way, it's also endless. The amount that you can extract from fear about a medical infection is endless. And you could say, oh, well, now we knew this time. But you see, I just saw actually Fauci said the other day, well, we need to be aware there's another
virus in China, we've identified it hasn't been transmitted to humans yet, but it has these various properties that, you know, it could be a really bad pandemic if it ever happens. I'm like, okay, you can do that forever.
Yeah, the knowledge disparity is so exploitable. And I was doing research. I mentioned the RT-qPCR tests, right? And I'm going down vertically into trying to understand how one of these damn tests actually can. Now, there is no test that can tell a person whether or not they have this virus, right? Definitively. Like a pregnancy test can tell you if you're pregnant or not, right?
Yeah.
That doesn't exist. And going down into the vertical and trying to understand, you know, like 4, 5, 6 steps down into this and realizing like, oh, dude, you're trying to make an outline for a show that you're doing tomorrow. Yeah. And look how down in the weeds you are on this thing. And the cynicism was, this is hopeless, right?
Yeah.
I'm above average intelligence and really committed and being held accountable by people in this audience who by and large are at least as smart as I am, if not smarter, you know, and we're going to press on this tomorrow. And this is impossible for me to understand, you know, this is hopeless. Those people who want to exploit this knowledge disparity, this is just one part of it. This is just one tiny fraction of this whole horizontal picture. People could never understand this. This is the opportunity of a lifetime.
Yes. Oh, what a wonderful insight. That the power of information asymmetry is unbelievable. Actually, the same thing happened at Bitcoin. I won't go into it, but because what happens is those individuals who do have more technical knowledge and who can at least speak the lingo will always beat you in a debate if they try. Because they'll say, and I saw this, I mean, with Bitcoin, I saw this over and over with this one particular developer named Greg Maxwell, who is also an interesting individual with interesting connections and interesting history.
Yeah.
But when there's some very, very straightforward arguments that anybody will be able to understand for why the block size should be increased, when technical measure should be increased. That's the way the code was designed. Well, this guy has such masterful technical knowledge that if you're trying to engage with him on the technical code level, you're going to fail.
Yeah.
He's like top of the game. You can't, from somebody who's observing the conversation from the outside, they're going to walk away saying, oh, this Greg Maxwell guy. Yeah. I mean, he seemed to make a better, he had a response to all the things that the other people were saying. So what the horrible thing is, in some cases like this, you don't even need the depth of technical knowledge because some of the arguments are fairly straightforward. But people who have that information asymmetry can beat you over the head with it all day. And somebody like in the medical profession, oh my gosh, the level of technical detail that is in medical testing and diseases and how the body functions, it's so phenomenally complex. You're going to have an incredibly difficult time trying to dive into something like that, which I want to ask you, by the way, did you get into was this partially caused because of the history of the guy who developed PCR saying that it's kind of been abused?
I think a lot of people who want to like invalidate the PCR test will say that Carrie Mullis has this one really damning quote in a letter that he sent to Tommy Morrison. Tommy Morrison was a boxer, was diagnosed with HIV. I don't think he actually had it. He said to her, this test cannot be used this way to tell you and your husband this definitive outcome. And I think I'm actually still researching that, but he made some contradictory statements over a large period of time, like a period of time where it's okay to contradict yourself because you might have new information or things might change or all of those reasons. But there is a lot of intrigue around Mullis's statements about PCR tests can't be used this way for viruses.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I haven't done a bunch of research into this, but I have seen a few things like that are fascinating. I don't think I read the letter, but there's an interview he gave I saw on YouTube, probably maybe like half an hour or so, where he was going into some detail about, I think it was specifically with regards to AIDS. So I don't know if his criticism was unique to using PCR for AIDS or something, but it was interesting to hear because this is the story that keeps repeating itself over and over and over in a bunch of disciplines, is you have a great thinker whose ideas eventually become tortured, whose breakthroughs become bastardized.
Right.
And a lot of times they, over time, they'll get dismissed from the profession as a crank. Einstein would be one of them.
And that was Mullis Einstein. Around HIV and AIDS. Yeah, that was
They happened to Mullis.
Yeah.
It's happened to other, the dude, one of the guys who was working on DNA, he's devoted his life to vitamin C research after that, said he could do all these miraculous things. And there's like, oh, well, he's a crank now. That just happens over and over and over and over in a bunch of different areas.
And it only takes one thing. It could be like, I have questions. It doesn't even have to be a statement, Steve. It could be like, I have questions about climate science.
Yeah.
You know? All right. Goodbye.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks for your contributions.
Well, and Einstein's this funny story because he was like one of the founders of modern quantum mechanics. There was this big, big divide in the history of interpretations of quantum mechanics. Einstein on one side and buffoons on the other. And he to his grave, he refused the Copenhagen interpretation, the contemporary, well, I shouldn't say contemporary anymore, the interpretation, dominant interpretation of the 20th century. He refused to his grave. And so the story of Einstein is, oh, the poor old man went senile. He made some great breakthrough discoveries, but he just wasn't up to the times. The people that took his ideas kind of took the good parts and then bastardized some of the other parts, made very poor arguments when you actually listened to them. They're like, oh, yeah, well, we just surpassed him. The poor man fell into crankery and became, you know, we had to move past it. We wise intellects. Actually, the same thing happened to Bitcoin. Ironically enough, these Bitcoin developers did the same thing with Satoshi. They were like, Satoshi, yeah, well, he designed the system a particular way, but, you know, we actually know better. And then they come up with this ridiculous new technical and economic model that's not going to work.
Right. And usually there's a narrative that a lot of people have gotten really comfortable with too, when maybe the originator of the idea or somebody who was looked to as a really formative thinker in whatever this thing is or whatever this development is, it's kind of like, all right, you're old news at this point. And maybe it doesn't even take it. It's just maybe that an agenda attaches to it. And then,
A lot of those people tend to be less socially ambitious, I think is a fair way to put it.
Yeah.
So they can just be run over. So if you've got a group of second-rate thinkers around a first-rate thinker, the second-rate thinkers might be aware of this fact and organize themselves and create a new narrative or a new institution around themselves to make themselves look wiser than they otherwise are. I think that's also the case that's happened in many disciplines.
Right. So we've been talking about who's too zoomed in. And we really went into detail on that. I also wanted to ask you, in the whole picture of the last of 2020 so far, who's too zoomed out? In your video, you give this example of like, imagine trying to understand the Earth from the perspective of the sun. And you're like, it's a blue dot with a black background, right? Yeah. You'd miss some things. And I think obviously there's lots of like great translations to identity politics and to whiteness or blackness right now. Seeing the Earth at that resolution is obviously producing a lot of same problems in identity issues in society. But even if you just want to, I mean, you could pick that or you could continue on with the COVID-19 stuff. Who's too zoomed out?
Yeah, well, it's everybody's too zoomed out. It's a mistake that everybody makes, and it's hard to correct it if you aren't aware of it. An example with the COVID thing, there are many examples here, but a basic abstraction from the graphs, let's say. So if you remember at the early parts of COVID, people were saying, it's exponential, bro.
Yeah.
Like, well, we have to do all these unprecedented things because look, this in this graph, it goes like that, which means apocalypse. That means like in a couple of years, there will be trillions of people that are now infected with this and it's going to be terrible.
Yeah.
So this would be an example of an abstraction error of zooming out. People think that's I can't even say it without laughing because it's so bad, but people confuse what graphs are and their explanatory power for the world, especially from the more complex phenomenon you're trying to describe, the less mathematics has anything relevant to say about it whatsoever.
Oh, so like, graphs are so decisive though.
Exactly. They are. And people go, okay, a curve correctly plots the motion of an object, of an accelerating object. If you throw a ball, you can graph it, and boy, that graph does a good job. Therefore, graphs in general can predict the future. So if you see a graph that has some prediction about infection rate or anything related to humans, well, by George, you just follow the graph and you'll be able to accurately predict the future of what will happen.
Right.
Well, no, that's not how the world works. The world of humans is phenomenally complex. So graphs like that tend not to give you any predictive power. To zoom in to see why this is a problem more. Part of the ways that those graphs are created is by academic modeling. And what they're trying to do, like with the imperial model, is they're trying to put into code the motion and interactions of living humans in Britain, like in London. So the way that they come up with this model is the way I read about it, I thought it was a good analogy. They're essentially trying to build SimCity in code. And try to, and part of their models are, they're saying, okay, well, people generally are this close to one another. They put some numerical amount on it and they go, oh, and they walk, when they walk around, they visit this facility and they go to the church and they go to their family and they whatever. So they're trying to predict the physical motion of the individuals, trying to put a quantitative number on this. They're trying to literally predict human behavior with numbers. They're trying to model an entire city in code and say that that is the prediction. That's what we're going to see in the future. Never realizing the most elementary effects that people voluntarily change their behavior. If there's actually a pandemic going on and people are aware of it, they're going to freaking change their behavior. They're not going to just act the exact way that you have predicted in your model. That's just one trivial example.
Mm-hmm.
So
there was a site, just real quick, there was a site called COVID Act Now that also turned out to be wrong about a lot of its modeling, but it would give you like these different graphs of like, if we do nothing, if we do social distancing, if we do China style lockdown. So, I mean, at the very least, systems thinking again, it's an attempt to synthesize, right? To look at the big picture and the smaller picture. And obviously, the smaller picture is much more controllable in some places than other places, right? Like politics is a factor in that, right? Like Massachusetts is a lot easier to model than New Hampshire. New Hampshire is the live free or die state. Massachusetts is the opposite.
Right.
That would be a factor.
Conceive, if you can, of how stupid this is. It's hard to do, but bear with me.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine somebody is trying to model the future of an infectious disease, and they build their model based on the density of London. And then they try to predict the horrors that will happen in Montana from the model, but the model itself is already going to be flawed, but from the model that they build in London. Like imagine how bad an idea that is. The lives of people living in a rural world are completely different.
Yeah.
Especially if you're talking about epidemiology, like the people they're in contact with, it's a completely different type of life than if you're living in New York City or in London. So to think from a policy perspective that you would have lockdowns and the same type of behaviors in London and New York as you would in Montana is lunacy. It's absolutely, utterly ridiculous. They're trying to build SimCity.
Yeah.
And you can tweak the variables. So the model might apply to London and tell you this. The model might apply to a more rural area and tell you that. But
okay.
I'm saying that is a problem of zooming out when you're saying, oh, we have a model here and this work. The model doesn't even work, but let's say the model works. We're going to apply it there because, hey, models work and it looks very mathy. And it works in physics, so that type of reasoning is probably going to work in epidemiology as well.
Absolutely. Anybody else before I ask my final question?
Yeah, well, I mean, sure. It's everybody. Right. Anybody else is everybody.
Yeah, yeah. Personal. Can you think of a time where you were researching, really wrestling with something, and realized you were too far in or too far out? What was it?
Oh, my gosh. It's an embarrassment of riches. Every thought I've ever had, I mean, looking at it in hindsight, it's too far zoomed in, too far zoomed out. The biggest change for me with this mistake was actually about the methodology of economics. So this really is an interesting topic, and people should listen to the interview I had with Bob Murphy on the topic. But there's one school of the Austrian School of Economics, which are the a priorists, that say you can know certain truths about economics without appealing to the real world. And there's some truth in that, but it gets extended way, 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 way too far.
Right.
One example, if we're trying to analyze the results of the minimum wage, does the minimum wage cause unemployment or not? Well, you can have a very tight conceptual analysis which says that the minimum wage has to cause unemployment because you're forcing the price level above market clearing price, which essentially means you're mandating some type of disemployment.
Right.
But this is mistaken because the world, but that type of reasoning appeals to ceteris paribus reasoning, which is like you imagine holding all variables constant and you tweak one variable and you try to imagine what the effects are.
Right.
The world doesn't work like that. So it could be, for example, though I don't believe this is the world that we live in, it could be that we live in a world in which when the minimum wage actually goes up, it changes people's beliefs about themselves. And when they change, let's say when they have a higher income, they are more confident and more productive because they feel like they're getting paid more because they're more valuable. Now, if that's the case, if that's the world in which we live, then raising the minimum wage might actually increase employment and wealth because people become better workers. That is now an empirical question. Do we live in a world in which people's psychologies work like that? That's not something you can just appeal to the logic of the thing. I'm saying in the world, there might be multiple variables connected that actually give us a counterintuitive result like that.
So that kind of modeling is a problem because of the causality, right? Like, so just tweaking one variable and expecting the others to stay the same doesn't work because the tweaking of one variable causes the other variables to change.
Exactly. And it's valuable to be able to do that type of reasoning because you're identifying cause and effect. So in that example, we could say that, well, it's not only that the minimum wage increased. It's not that the thing which caused the increased production is that the costs of production increase. That's true. But it's that the increase in the minimum wage caused the other variables to change that actually had the net result of, let's say, increasing employment. An example I like to give is in the martial arts, where there's a phenomenon that happens in the martial arts where when kids will be awarded a higher color belt, a lot of times their performance will immediately improve because they think of themselves, well, they're now the blue belt, which means they are better practitioners. Maybe they're more confident, so that improves their technique a little bit. It's like the winner effect. And so somebody might, using this type of reasoning, they might think to themselves, but ceteris paribus, a different color belt, does not make you a better martial artist.
Right.
So therefore, actually, kids can't improve their skill level by giving them a higher colored belt. It's like, well, no, but the change in the color of the belt does change these other variables that results in kids performing better. And I actually experienced this in reverse. When I got my first black belt in karate, this was such a weird a moment because I immediately recognized my skill level dropped. My techniques were way sloppier and I was trying to be as good as I was, but I think I was so focused on getting that black belt that, like, once I already got it, my body was like, why am I doing this? I don't really have to be here. I already achieved the thing I wanted to achieve. And my skill level got worse because of the color of my belt changed.
Wow. Interesting. So the reason why I asked you that about, like, a personal experience is I'd be interested if you could. I know it's kind of a difficult question because it's happened in so many places. And I think that's something we can all identify with is, like, wow, I'm, you know, too in the weeds or I'm too big picture. And I think, like, the zoomed out that a lot of people in my audience would probably identify with is, like, you take a certain philosophical worldview to current events and you say, oh, I know what this is, right? You try, you go through this very quick thinking fast, make myself comfortable kind of, like, I'm going to take this and fit it into my existing worldview by, as I take it, I'm going to form it into this thing that I understand that fits this puzzle that I'm already putting together, right? So if we're zoomed out and we're saying, all right, well, this is the worldview that I have, or this is the philosophy that I apply to understanding the individual things that I see, that's a very easy mistake to make. But how would you recommend people do the work to move between the two in their pursuits most effectively.
So I'll just tell you my own journey with this, and maybe other people will find it valuable. Because I am pigheaded and slow in many areas, like my wife will tell you, I can be very blockheaded. You know, it takes a long time to penetrate the brain. Sometimes when it's there, it does good things, but I can overlook things for a long period of time, partly because of this problem that you've described. But for me, it was realizing simply how big a mistake I was making, or being exposed to a resolution that I was not thinking in, and realizing, oh my gosh, I've missed some critical thing. Go back to the martial arts example. When I first got trained in stand-up, in striking, and I thought to myself, and this was encouraged by other instructors, that like, that is the martial arts. There is essentially one dimension to self-defense, which is punching and kicking with strength and power and speed. I was like, oh yeah. And I excelled at that, right? Got my black belt. Wow. I must really know what I'm talking about. And then somehow got exposed to grappling and Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And I'm like, oh, this and other stuff is actually way more important, actually. It's not just another dimension. It's like, if you want to build your basics, you should probably build them on Gracie jiu-jitsu first. And then maybe you can build out to striking. I was totally mistaken. I had no conception of it. If you will, I was too zoomed in. Mm-hmm. I was too zoomed in on one thing in the martial arts, but I didn't know I was that zoomed in. I had to feel the embarrassment of being that level of wrong. That would be one example. The best thing to do is try to expose yourself to people who are making more technical arguments that might end up being very, very important, and people that are making bigger picture arguments that you might disagree with or not have exposure to that might turn out to be very, very important. And the biggest obstacle, in my opinion, I maybe I'm wrong about this, I think the biggest obstacle is psychological, because it is so embarrassing to have some self-assessed mastery of some discipline, way of thinking, way of doing something, and realize you don't even understand the basics. Going back to our first conversation we had 4 years ago, right? Process of learning, you got to learn the basic techniques, and you don't even know what the basic techniques are. You don't even know what the basic processes of thinking are. You don't even realize how what you believe connects to your theory of epistemology, and you don't realize your theory of epistemology is wrong, which means all of your other beliefs are wrong. I think just exposure to that embarrassment, at least for me, has been very helpful for realizing I better be able to manually zoom in and zoom out so I avoid these types of errors in the future.
Right. And I said earlier in the conversation that false sense of a solution or understanding is a great comfort, you know, especially in a time where things move very quickly. You're accountable to, you know, some kind of social media following, if you are, or to people that you talk to, or you feel that way accountable to yourself, and you want to feel right. You want to feel like you're making meaning of the vastly complex things that are going on in the world, and you might just settle for a shortcut or two, like we've talked about before. For me, you know, removing ego is a really valuable part of being able to do this better. And
embarrassing it into submission.
Well, yeah. So there's that, but which I've certainly experienced that too. But with this whole COVID research for the show, I've sunk a lot of time into this. And at this point, I'm just like, I'm so fatigued by this whole thing. I don't care. It's a badge of honor to try and develop some kind of understanding of the science of what's going on. Mm. And I don't care in the end if I'm wrong about everything that I said publicly, if I can just be, I don't want to say done, because you're never done, certainly not in science, but if I can just be over this thing. So I've said that on the show, and it felt good to say, like, my identity is not at all wrapped up in my conclusions here. And that's a wonderful way to be. And it makes it easier to go, well, I'm too focused in on this, or I'm too big picture and I need to make an adjustment, and I need to learn how to move back and forth more gently.
Yeah. One more practical recommendation on this. I have discovered disciplines are not isolated from one another.
Oh, sure.
And it is a grave mistake to only specialize in one thing. And there are patterns of reasoning you can discover doing something completely separate that can apply to whatever you're trying to learn. It could be a lot of my early intellectual journey was indirectly through chess. Like there are particular things you can learn through chess that will teach you about the world, that will teach you about critical thinking, that will teach you about jujitsu. If you have the ability to abstract those principles from one domain to another, you'll find it much easier to be able to zoom in and zoom out.
Absolutely. I often ask people, how many conversations have you had with a doctor about food? You know, probably zero. You know,
yeah.
Most people. So, yeah, the interconnectedness of disciplines is a really, really important thing. And I agree. It's tragically overlooked in many, many cases. So, Steve, thank you for an extra hour of your time. Thank you for coming on the show when you're not actively promoting anything, but your site is still up. It's steve-patterson, right.com.
Yeah. I like to call Steve-Patterson. Steve-Patterson just sounds that, well, man, I don't know. Bad marketing.
The YouTube channel is still up. They can find you just by searching Steve Patterson, right? And the podcast is Patterson in Pursuit.
That's right. And by the way, I wore this, I have merch now. I have one shirt of merch, and it's this shirt. It says, I don't know if you can read, I don't know if it's backwards or not. It says, this is a circle.
Yep.
And has an arrow pointing to a circle.
Yeah.
First time I wore this, I got some guy, we were at Whole Foods, and some guy was like, oh, I like your circle, or your shirt, man.
Yeah.
It's like, sure, you don't understand it, but it's a math joke. So I don't know how much in detail we've gone in here. This is, I say this is guaranteed to upset a mathematician. Because the question is it a circle or is it not? Ask a mathematician that with this shirt on, and you're gonna anger some people. You're gonna have an interesting conversation. So you can go to Teespring now, and I think if you just put in like this is a circle or something like that, it'll come up and you can get it. And if anybody does that, please do send me a picture of it on Facebook, because I'll get such a chuckle of the idea that somebody else is taunting mathematicians with a little bit of heresy.
It is an awesome looking t-shirt. It's thought provoking and I totally don't get it, but
we'll have to talk about it later.
Yeah. I'd love to talk to you again soon. Let's just follow up like within a couple months or so. You want to do that?
Yeah, man. Just send me a message. I'm good to go.
Awesome. There's going to be lots of developments, I'm sure. Steve, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was great to reconnect with you, and I look forward to the next time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks again for having me.